bring you one. We will get to it tonight, but you'll need it for future classes. You're welcome. Anybody else? As we've been saying, these are also available on the website. And after we've passed them out before class, if you don't get one then, they're always on the front pew up here in the corner. You can get one at your leisure. Try to make it easy for everybody. Okay, we're in Job chapter 12 in your Bibles. And we are about ready to finish up chapter 12. And in your handouts, we're on page 12. Somewhere we're going to finish up question 6. And get into chapter 13, which is question 7. I'd like to get chapter 14 done tonight. Chapters 13 and 14. That's my plan. Might not get it done. If we get into good discussion, I'd rather have that than get the lesson done, because the good comments are good. We like those. But we're going to try to stay on somewhat of a schedule to get Job completed by the end of the quarter. All right, as you recall, on Sunday we were talking about this is the argument or the speech of Zophar. And he, of the three, he's had the least tact. He's been the most brutal in his comments to Job, his insinuations. Said Job was talkative, boastful. He was scoffing in the sense that Job was maintaining his innocence before God, and the three were ridiculing his defense. He was convinced that if God were to speak, Job would agree with his friends. And remember, Job, that's not worded correctly. Is it? He was convinced that if God were to speak, Job would agree. I don't like how that's worded. I think I meant to say that God would agree with them rather than agree with Job. I don't think that's worded correctly. But anyway, Job has been wanting this meeting, and Zophar seemed to be saying, Job, you don't really want to have that meeting, because you will find out that we're right and you're wrong, and God would side with us instead of side with you. Again, some more insinuations. He expounds upon God's greatness and His wisdom and His power. Even the strong statement in verse 12, the day that a donkey gives birth to a man is the day that a fool, insinuating that's Job, would understand what's going on. So, real biting, caustic comments. So like the other two, he says, Job, you need to repent. Let's get your life back right like it ought to be. And then things will be okay. Nothing new. The other two have said the same thing. Zophar. So there's been no real new revelation here with respect to the speeches of the friends. Then we get to chapter 12. And this is when Job, to me, is at his most terse self. He's had it with how these friends have continually ridiculed him and spoken ill of him. And he says, the day that you die, what happens to wisdom, did he say, the first part of chapter 12? It'll leave the earth. When you all go, there'll be no more smart guys left. So Job is finally fighting back, if you will, or if you please, with some terse comments of his own. So he is thoroughly disgusted with his friends. He says, you're not any smarter than I am. I know a lot of the stuff that you know also. In fact, he said, even the earth and all those who are in it, the animal life, everyone knows what you've been saying. So you've not been offering any great pearls of wisdom. So Job is not going to illustrate his own wisdom. And this is a large section of the text, chapter 12, verses 5 through 25 that we'll cover rather quickly. He rebukes the three for their contempt of him. You see there in verse 5 of chapter 12. He who was at ease, and I take that to mean a reference to Zophar. He who is at ease holds calamity. Who's in calamity? Well, Job's in calamity. You hold me in contempt. As prepared for those whose feet slip. The tents of the destroyers prosper, and those who provoke God are secure, whom God brings into their power. So he refutes their theory that the wicked never prosper, and they've been saying all along. Now, if the wicked, if a man is wicked, he's not going to prosper. And if a man is righteous, according to their theology, he's never going to suffer. That's just how that is. That's like 2 + 2 = 4. That's one of the unalterable rules of life. Well, he's going to put that to rest somewhat. Do the wicked prosper in life? Sure they do. Of course, the finality of that is, will they in the end prosper? And of course, the answer is no. They will at last fail because they have lived their lives apart from God. Will the righteous suffer in life? Yes, they will. Job's suffering. But at last will the righteous suffer. If he's held to God, if he's held to his God and lived in faith, God will at last reward him and end his suffering and reward him accordingly. So Job is refuting this theory that they have been holding all along. And he again states that their wisdom, you see in verses 7 through 12, the animals know it, the earth knows it, the aged people know it. You've not really said anything that's such a great revelation to me. This verses 7 through 12. Job says, ask the beasts, let them teach you. Let the birds of the heavens, let them tell you. Speak to the earth, and let it teach you. Let the fish of the sea declare to you. See, what you've said, who among all these things does not know that the hand of the Lord has done this? In whose hand is the life of every living thing? Wisdom is with aged men, with long life is understanding. So again, Job is just saying, you know, you've not really helped me. Job never has said, all that you said is false. They have said some true things, but they've not been any help to him. No, nothing that would ease his pain or his anguish or his suffering. So he then, Job himself, expounds upon the majestic power of God and his ability to control all that exists. And if you read verses 13 through 25, Job is speaking about how God is the absolute control of all that's in the universe. Mentions, if God tears it down, verse 14, what happens? It's not going to be built back up. If God takes care of that, then that's it. That's how powerful God is. If God both restrains and sends the waters, who can undo that? God says to the waters, that's as far as you go. They don't go any farther. If God turns the waters loose, nobody can hold them back because God's behind all that. So Job, again, is showing the same understanding of the power of God that these friends have illustrated or shown. God confounds counselors and judges. That's in verse 17. Look how Job praises that. He makes counselors, and my verse says he makes counselors walk barefoot. Well, that's an interesting way to put that. Well, the translations say what? What's the New King James say? All right, he leads them away plundered, as if to say the wise men sometimes are taken into captivity and they're led away plundered or barefoot without anything. If they're so smart, they could figure that out. But God is behind all of that, and man cannot thwart God. The last part of verse 17, he makes fools of judges, speaking, of course, from human wisdom standpoint. So, again, Job is just simply saying what the three have said. Who controls the nations based on verse 23? We know God does that. And there is certainly New Testament teaching that corresponds with that. Romans 13 would teach that about civil government. What did Daniel at one time tell King Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 4 of the book of Daniel? He says, you're going to wind up out in the field doing what? Eating grass until you recognize what? God's in control. And what happened to him? That's what happened to him. So, this is nothing that is such a sudden and new revelation that, oh, you know, I hadn't thought about that. Well, that makes all this make sense now. No, Job is just saying All he's saying here in his final answer to Zophar, I know what you know about things. You bring no help to me in my suffering. So, go ahead. No, it doesn't. He's still searching for answers. These things do not help him understand why he's suffering. He's just answering these three men with what they said to him. That what you've said is no help to me. It's no aid to me. It's no comfort or benefit to me. I know what these things about just like you do. So Job illustrates his own wisdom. Now that's through the end of chapter 12. Now we get to chapter 13, and Job again asserts, on the heels of how chapter 12 concludes, he again asserts his own wisdom. Behold, my eye has seen all this, my ear has heard and understood it. What you know, I also know. I am not inferior to you. Job's not bragging. He's just saying, again, to these three, you're not any higher in this than I am. And as we've been pointing out the last two classes or so, particularly the last couple of classes, Job is wanting this meeting with God. He's wanting an audience with God. He's got some questions he wants to ask God, particularly about his situation. Zophar has said, Job, you don't want that meeting. Job said, no, I tell you, I do want that meeting. And verse 3 of chapter 13. But if I would speak to the Almighty, if I got the chance to sit down with God and have a face-to-face meeting. Now, the last part of verse 3, there are some differences in the translations. The American Standard says, I desire to argue with God. Reason. I want to have a dialogue with Him. And I want to know why all this is happening. Now, you call that an argument, or you call it reasoning, a contention. Job's wanting some information. So he says, if I could talk with the Almighty, if I could speak to Him, I'd have some things I want to say. I've got questions that I think, from my perspective, they need answering. Now, he knows at last who has the answers. Well, first off, he knows who doesn't have the answers. His friends don't have the answers. I know God's got the answers. And so I want to know. I've got to have answers to my dilemmas. Now, as far as the three friends, look in verses 4 through 12. Job is, he's not as polite anymore as he used to be. So in verse 4, he says, now look at verse 3, and we'll pick up verse 3 in this context. If I would, or there's no if there, but I would speak to the Almighty, and I desire to argue with God, but you smear with lies. You are all worthless physicians. Okay, reason or argue. That's in verse 3. You're right, Brother Tom. Oh, that you would be completely silent. Now, who's he talking to there? The friends. You all have said enough. If you want to help me, be quiet. Don't say any more. That you would be completely silent, and that it would become your wisdom. Let your silence be your wisdom. Show your wise by being quiet. Please hear my argument and listen to the contentions of my lips. Will you speak what is unjust for God and speak what is deceitful for Him? Will you show partiality for Him? Will you contend for God? Will it be well when He examines you? Or will you deceive Him as one deceives a man? He will surely reprove you. If you secretly show partiality, will not His majesty terrify you? And the dread of Him fall on you. Your memorable sayings are proverbs of ashes, and your defenses are as defenses of clay. I've not heard Job speak this strongly. But now he's...
Maybe he's responding in kind.
Well, I think that's what he's doing. Yes. He's giving Zophar a dose of his own medicine in terms of how biting he was to Job. So these are worthless physicians, proverbs of ashes. Notice what he says here. Please be silent. I want you to listen to me. Now just listen. He says, quit being so judgmental and listen to what I've got to say. Maybe you'll understand me better if you'll really listen to me. He says, really, I think you're the ones that are in trouble. because they have unfairly spoken for God. They're claiming to speak on whose behalf? God's behalf. And again, not to jump too far ahead, but you get to the end of the book, chapter 42. God reproves the three. He says, "You have not spoken about me as has my servant Job." God was not pleased with them. And therefore, that's when he asked Job to act as priest and offer sacrifice for them on their behalf because they spoke wrongly. Now, Job spoke wrongly too, but Job didn't speak as they did. It's a different situation to correct. But he says, "Surely God's going to reprove you because you have not spoken well. You're not contending for God. I don't believe that you're speaking on behalf of God." Verse 10, God's going to reprove you. He will correct you for this. Job is sure of that. Absolutely sure of that. Isn't it kind of ironic that Job's having to take time out of his suffering to work on this situation? But he had to nonetheless. Okay. Now, this is a difficult section of chapter 13. I admit that. And maybe someone here can help me with how to understand this better. This, to me, is challenging. I see verses 13 through 19 of chapter 13 as Job entering some dangerous territory. Now, I may be wrong in how I understand these seven verses. But let's look at them carefully and see if we can find out what's being said here. 13 through 19. Matt Davis, if you'll read those seven verses for us, please, then we'll talk about them. Okay. Verse 14. Interesting question. Well, let's start in verse 13. Again, he says to the friends, "Be silent before me so that I may speak." Job is determined to speak, wanting God to hear him, wanting to have this conversation. The last part of verse 13, what does Job admit? "If I speak, I'm willing to take whatever consequences God will dish out to me as I speak in my anguish and in my grief and in the bitterness of my condition. I'll accept those consequences. Then let come on me what may." Now verse 14. "Why should I take my flesh in my teeth and put my life in my hands?" That's an interesting phrase. It seems that Job is saying, when he says at the end of verse 13, "I'm going to speak out and let whatever happens, let it happen. I'm willing to put my flesh in my own teeth. I'm willing to risk my very life, knowing that if God is displeased now with what I'm going to say, He might just smite me. It might just take my life." But Job was willing to say that. He's that much in anguish, making demands of God. Remember, he's calling God into question. He wants to bring the Almighty down and have this conversation. In an earlier chapter, remember, Job wanted an umpire. He wanted a mediator who would bring the two parties together, Job being one party, God being the other party. "I've got questions." Of course, the futility of that request, Job knew what? There was no such umpire who would be above God in the sense that could bring God into this meeting. God's on a different level. But that's what Job wanted, asked for nonetheless. So he's going to take his flesh into his own teeth. Now look at verse 15. Verse 15. Matt, read again verse 15. And you're reading from the New King James? Is that what it is? Okay. All right. The first part of verse 15 has been one of the most beautiful passages in the Old Testament for generations. Though he slay me, yet I'll trust him. And that's a beautiful thought. But this is admittedly a difficult passage. Now, I'm reminded of something Bob said not long ago in a sermon on Sunday morning. And I don't think I'm going to be taking him out of context. But the gist of Bob's comment was, I think, I forget now exactly what he was talking about per se on that point, but the overall point he was making was is that far too many times in preaching, the way some men preach, they cause more doubts in the minds of men than giving them answers. We want to be in the business of giving comfort and giving answers rather than raising or causing doubts. And I think we all would agree with that. I thought the purpose of preaching is to make more questions, is to try to give answers to things that we're thinking about. And I don't want to be guilty of doing that tonight, but there are some different translations that render the first part of verse 15 differently than the one that Matt just read. Though he slay me, yet I will trust in him. Does anybody have the Old American Standard in class? Nobody has the Old American Standard. Let me read that to you out of the Old American Standard. Job 13, verse 15. Behold, he will slay me. I have no hope. Well, that's nothing like what Matt just read. Different idea altogether. Behold, he will slay me. Not if he will. I'll still trust in him. He will slay me. I have no hope. Let me read the English Standard Version. I've got a bunch of Bibles up here open. Though he slay me, I will hope in him, yet I will argue my ways to his face. Job was convinced in his mind, I'm treading on thin ice here. I'm going to argue my case. It may cost me my life. Now, most translations render the passage, even though that happens, I'm still going to trust in him. And that speaks well of Job. He hadn't lost his faith. But what's interesting to me, let me read this to you out of the Septuagint, which, of course, is the Greek translation of the Old Testament Scripture. If I can find it here. It's in the small print. Okay. Though the Mighty One should lay hand upon me, for as much as he has begun, verily I will speak and plead before him. So that gives an indication that it had already happened. He had already done so. Out of the Hebrew Scripture, the Hebrew Old Testament, verse 15. He may well slay me, I may have no hope, yet I will argue my case before him. And then finally, let me give you just what one writer says is the literal translation of the passage. Literally, the verse reads, Behold, he shall slay me, I shall not wait, but my ways to his face I will defend. And a lot of Hebrew scholars say that the word translated trust or hope in the passage is better translated wait. It's the idea of waiting on the Lord, trusting on the Lord. So the idea seems to be, we have two competing ideas here. One version, or a lot of versions say, even though he slay me, I still got hope in him. I still trust him. And that's true. We could see where Job would be thinking that. On the other hand, if we take these passages to mean that Job has entered some dangerous waters here, and he's speaking out, and he's admitting it up front, this may not be wise for me to do this, but I'm going to speak out anyway because of my condition. Though he slay me, I don't have any hope. I'm not going to wait for God to judge me later. He may be judging me right now because I'm going to speak out in an untoward way. I think both positions are plausible. Now, which one's better? Well, you decide. I'm not trying to cause doubts. I'm just trying to find out what the text is actually saying. But Job is saying, I believe, and the context begins in verse 13. He's admittingly taking his flesh into his own teeth. I'm entering a dangerous place here, calling God into question. But I'll tell you, I am so tormented and I'm so vexed, I just have to know this. I want answers. I don't think Job was even asking. I think Job was almost demanding answers. And for that, again, going to the end of the book, when Job says, "Therefore I declare what I did not know, therefore I retract and I repent in ashes." This is what Job was repenting of. Speaking ill of God, demanding God answer him, and calling God's moral fairness into question. Because he has said on more than one occasion, and he will continue to say as we'll go through the next few chapters, he's accusing God of being unfair. The wicked are prospering, and here I am. I'm suffering, and I'm not living like they are. And he called God into question about that too. So some difficult passages. I'm not trying to make this hard. I'm just saying there are some difficult sections in the book, and I think this is one of them. And you can reason it out as I try to reason it out. We try to understand what we think Job is saying. Anybody have a comment that you want to make about verse 15? Yes, Buford. Well, look in verse 15. Though he slay me. Yes, he's talking about God. Yes. Well, that's entirely possible, Buford, I would say. That's correct. I guess the only distinction I would make between what you've just said would be, even though Job is not talking to God directly, he is saying it about God. Now, I don't see much difference whether you say it right to God's face or say it to somebody else. God still is going to hear it. And he's still questioning God's control of things. I'm not trying to be nitpicky, but I'm just saying, Job is saying things again that he ought not say. Yes, that is correct. Yes, he knows that he's not in the position that he's in because of sin. He knows that. Now, the friends, again, do not accept that theory. He does. But the only point I'm trying to raise is that when Job is saying things like this, this is when this is where he is the farthest way from where he ought to be. I mean, he has drifted off into areas he ought not be, saying things that he ought not to say. Now, and I think we need to see that at least. Now, he'll come back from that, and he'll repent of that. But he is saying it nonetheless. And there are other statements here, especially down in verses 24, 26, and 27 of this chapter, where Job again says things about God. And in fact, I think in those passages, he is speaking to God, not just about God, but speaking to God. Go ahead.
Just in case of letting it all hang out.
Well, he is. Job is letting it go. He is. In verse 18, to correspond to what you're saying, Buford, behold, now I have prepared my case. I've written my arguments out. Last part of verse 18 says what, though? I know in the end I'll be found right. So that agrees with what you just said. So Job knows. He knows that it's not as bad as these three guys are making it out to be. But that's not good enough for Job, because he still sees himself suffering and he can't figure out why. Because I've not done what they said I've done. So again, not to be so redundant, but we know the reason why. We were present when the book began for that conversation. We were privy to that. Job was not. So Job's trying to rationalize this out in his mind, so to speak, trying to find some rationale to it. Okay. Now, he was so sure of his standing that he would so argue before God. Verses 16 through 19. Notice he says about himself, or implies about himself. Verse 16 mentions a godless man or an ungodly man. They don't have the right to stand before God. Or a hypocrite. That's not Job. See, I'm not a hypocrite. I'm not ungodly. So I know I'm better off than that. Therefore, I have somewhat of a right to make my case before God. He knew, again, verse 18, in the end he would be vindicated. So, again, we see some reasons why he felt this way. He makes requests and inquires of God, verses 20 through 28 of chapter 13. And he says, God, I want two things of you. Verse 20. Only two things do not do to me, then I will not hide from thy face. What's the first thing he requests in verse 21? All right, don't withdraw your hand from me. Don't take away your hand from me. What's the second one? That's right. Do not let thy dread fall upon me. Make me so afraid that I'm not that I won't speak. Because if a man's afraid enough, he won't even talk to God. Now Job doesn't have positive things to say here. He's got some answers that he's wanting. He's got some arguments to make. So, he wanted to call upon God, and he wanted God to answer. Verse 22. Yes, he's wanting answers, Mike. He's not wanting God to undo it all. He's never asked for that. But he's wanting to call the Almighty down and say, now you answer me. Why have you done this to me? And that's putting the cart before the horse, isn't it? That's making God answer man rather than man being answerable to God. That's got it backwards. And that's the problem that Job is having in this predicament here. So he's calling on God and wants God to provide these answers. I think that was a good way to sum that up, Mike. That's 23. Yes, verse 23. This is a request to God. How many are my iniquities and sins? Make known to me my rebellion and my sin. Now that is said to who? That's said to God. You show me where I have sinned. He just said it to the friends. Well, that's right. I mean, they've insinuated sin all along, but they've not given any specific evidence. There's been no evidence given. So the question is directly to God. Here I am sitting like I am suffering. Now, Job says, I know it's not because of my sins. I haven't done anything. So the question to God is, you show me where my sin is. Point out my rebellious actions and highlight my iniquities that will justify the way you're treating me, the way you're putting this on me. Now, that's a strong thing to say. That's a strong statement to make. And Job made it. Job made it.
Do you think Job's response in these passages are due to the pressure of these three friends?
I think that's a contributing factor, Bob. I don't think ever in the book, and Bob's question was, do you think that the words of the friends had anything to do with Job saying what he's saying? And we never find anything in the book, at least I don't think we do, where Job finally agreed with the three. He never did. But if you keep hearing something long enough, what's that tend to do? It tends to work on you some, don't it? At least to some extent it does. Yes, it does. Tom says it tears you down. So, again, I think I pointed this out earlier. Job, even though Job never did agree with the friends, I think Job did accept a reverse argument of it. They said again, Job, you're suffering because you're guilty of sin. Job is saying, I'm not guilty, yet why am I suffering? Both a connection to the argument of man only suffers because he's in sin. But Job didn't see it that way. He saw the reverse of it. I don't understand why I'm in this position because I've not committed any sin. So he's asking God, verse 23. Verse 22. Call and I will answer, or let me speak, then you reply to me. You reply to me. Now that's a high-minded thing for a man to say to God. How many are my iniquities and my sins? Make known to me my rebellion and my sin. Verse 24. Why dost thou hide thy face and consider me thy what? Thy enemy. Well, God's not man's enemy. But that's what Job said. Verse 26, "For thou dost write bitter things against me, and dost make me to inherit the iniquities of my youth. Thou dost put my feet in the stocks." Job felt imprisoned. Attributes this to God. God's actions upon him. So here's what Job is thinking. He asks that God show him his iniquities. He complains again of unfair treatment. And he's done this before in the book. "I'm thy enemy. You write bitter things about me. You put my feet in the stocks." Captive, if you will. Job is captive in his predicament. Attributes this to God doing so. So now in chapter 14, Job again begins to lament life's brevity. One of my favorite verses is verses 1 and 2. "Man who is born of woman is what? Full of turmoil and short-lived. As the flower that does what? Fades away." That's as long as man's life is. This short. And how is Job spending his short life right now? Not very good. Suffering. He's not enjoying life's brevity as it was. So life is short-lived. Man's times and actions are limited by God. You see, they're in verse 5 of chapter 14. Is this a true statement? Man's days are numbered. The number of his months is with God. And his limits God has set so that he cannot pass. Is that true? Yes, that's true. Acts 17 would be a comparable New Testament passage that would teach us, yes, God's in control of man's duration upon the earth. Absolutely. That's not an untrue statement. So again, Job shows wisdom, if you will. But now he says in verse 6, "Once God, turn thy gaze away from me, that I may rest, until he fulfills his day like a hired man." We're about on question 10 on page 12. We've come down that far in the material. So Job is lamenting again, if you will. And he then in a soliloquy or a monologue, if you will, verses 7 through 12 of chapter 14, he shows some hopelessness. He compares man to a what? To a tree. Now, Job says, what if you cut the tree down? What's going to happen to it eventually? It'll grow up again. There's life in that tree. And he even mentions the stump, doesn't he? Even though the stump dries in the dry soil, roots grow old in the ground. But at the scent of water, it will flourish. It'll begin to grow again. But man, verse 10, what about man? Who is prostrate. He's laying in the ground. Is there life for him again? Not as Job saw it. That's right. That's it. Man gets once and he's done. That's it. And life is so short, and then that's it. He's not as lucky as the tree is. What kind of man does it sound like you that Job's talking like right now? Hopeless. In great despair. Do you think Job knew of an afterlife? Was there life after death as far as Job knew? He had said words to that effect before. But he's not talking that way now. Which tells us what? Even the faithful can be so hard-pressed at times, they begin to think and act and talk like what? Like an unbeliever. They can. Absolutely, they can. Doesn't make it right. But that's the reality of things sometimes. And to get through those moments, what do we have to have so that we don't fall into that trap? We've got to have faith, character, the depth of conviction, knowing that God will not so abandon us like that as Job is thinking, calling God into question. It takes great faith to overcome the temptation to call God into question and to say things the way Job has been saying. So he sounds really hopeless now. I don't think Job ever totally abandoned his hope. I don't think he did. But he talks like that now. He's inching closer to doing it. Yes, Buford.
Job's main problem is that he doesn't understand this
probably like to say he doesn't understand that this is not God.
Yes. Right.
Satan is the one who is.
Yes. Job never knew that. And again, I think we said when we introduced the book, you get to the end of the book, which we'll get to the end of next month, there's no indication God ever told Job. Now, here's how this whole thing worked out. Job never knew. I'm not convinced that Job knew. I think Job went to his death not knowing why all this happened. And as we said, we may go to our grave. We may. Not fully understanding why life has dished out some very unpleasant moments for us. Now, we may know some things, but we may not know. But that doesn't give us the right to act in a way that would call God's control of the universe, if you will, and His moral control. We can't call that into question. Can't do it. Shouldn't do it. It takes great faith to walk by faith, not by sight. And we could think of many other passages to go along with that. So again, he compares to this tree. He only saw his life as a dried up river. That's in verse 11. As water evaporates from the sea, and a river becomes parched and dried up, so a man lies down and does not rise until the heavens be no more. He will not awake nor be aroused out of his sleep. He saw no future for man. And really, not just man in general. Who? Himself. I don't have a future. I don't have anything to look forward to. I guess not to be so trite, and I'm not trying to be trite, but Job is in the midst of one great big giant pity party right now. He is. And I've never suffered like this. So I'm not trying to make fun of him. But to be in such despair and such despondency and to speak out of that grief as he's doing, this is what he said. This is how he's thinking. This is how he's reasoning. Well, I'm sure it was tough.
We know some things we didn't know.
Yes. That is true.
We really can't blame him.
Well, blame him in the sense that he shouldn't have said it. I can say that.
Yeah, because we know the outcome.
Yes, we do. And this book is given to us for learning. We need to learn from Job and not make the mistakes that he made. Yes. But to judge him saying, well, I wouldn't have done that, I can't say that. Because I've not been to that degree of suffering. Okay. We'll pick up then in verse 13 of chapter 14, the Lord willing, on Sunday morning. Thank you all for your participation.